philosophical tree is an alchemical symbol of wholeness, when another symbol for wholeness, or a part of the alchemical process, is referred to, this can be confusing to the mind. But ultimately, this is just what needs to occur, a confounding of the mind, for the experience of wholeness can never be achieved by the mind, which can never do more than, quote, point at the moon, end quote, can never be the moon. A problem for our understanding can also arise in putting ourselves in the shoes of the alchemist, given the context of whatever period in which they live. But since the individuation process seems to remain essentially the same, and also the qualities of the human being, we can tune into, resonate with the experiences they describe. An appreciation that their language is abstract and metaphorical is another essential aspect to approaching and benefiting from their work. A reconciliation, in quotes, which may be a misleading term, of opposites is one feature of the work, and it occurs in various ways, and seems must needs entail suffering. That the essence of the greater is the same as the essence of the smaller, and when so disclosed, resolves the false bifurcation, is another part of the teaching. True healing is a theme. What is the real cause and cure of the sickness that afflicts man? There is a regard, reverence perhaps, for the intelligence and beneficence of nature, a mother, guide, and teacher, from which we receive our life, in a state of helpless disorientation, and with which we reintegrate, now fully conscious at the completion of the work. Prima materia is the ultima materia. And I made some quotes of some parts that struck me, but there were many of these, and maybe I'll read a couple. In the case of Dorn, we can see how the archetypal tree, which consisted of the ramifications of the bronchi, blood vessels, and veins of ore, was projected upon the empirical world and gave rise to a totalistic view which embraced the whole of organic and inorganic nature and the, quote, spiritual world as well. The philosophers called their stone, this is also Dorn, I believe, the philosophers called their stone animate because at the final operations, by virtue of the power of this most noble fiery mystery, a dark red liquid like blood sweats out drop by drop from their material in their vessel. And for this reason, they have prophesied that in the last days, a most pure man, through whom the world will be freed, will come to earth and will sweat bloody drops of a rosy or red hue, whereby the world will be redeemed from its fall. In like manner, too, the blood of their stone will free the leprous metals and also men from their diseases. Wherefore they have said, not without good reason, that their stone is animate. Concerning this, Mercurius speaks as follows to King Khalid. To know this mystery is permitted only to the prophets of God, and that is the reason why the stone is called animate, for in the blood of this stone is hidden its soul. It is also composed of body, spirit, and soul. For a like reason, they have called it their microcosm, because it contains the similitude of all things of this world, and therefore, again, they say that it is animate, as Plato calls the macrocosm animate. But now the ignorant have come who believe that the stone is threefold and is hidden in three fold kind, namely vegetable, animal, and mineral, once it has come to pass that they themselves have sought for it in minerals. But this teaching is far removed from the opinion of the philosophers, who maintain that their stone is vegetable, animal, and mineral in one and the same form. And Jung comments, this remarkable text explains the tree as a metaphorical form of the arcane substance, a living thing that comes into existence according to its own laws and grows, blossoms, and bears fruit like a plant. By becoming conscious, the individual is threatened more and more with isolation, which is nevertheless the sine qua non of conscious differentiation. The greater this threat, the more it is compensated by the production of collective and archetypal symbols, which are common to all men. The goal of the opus was to deliver the anima mundi, the world-creating spirit of God, from the chaos of vices. This image of the supra-celestial fire accords on the one hand with the much earlier, quote, ever-living fire of Heraclitus, and on the other with a much later interpretation of Mercurius as fire and as the spiritus vegetativus that pervades the whole of nature, both animating and destructive. The fruit that is, quote, not cast into the fire, end quote, is naturally the man who has stood the test, the, quote, pneumatic, end quote, man of the Gnostics, one of the synonyms for the lapis, which likewise signifies the, I can't make sense, I think there's a word here, the something, integrated man, is frumentum nostrum, our brain. Here's something. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am the Himalaya among mountains and the Ashvata among trees. The Ashvata tree, he goes on to say, creates the soma, which is maybe a drink of immortality. So there, these symbols are just seem to be universal. There's an equating of the tree with a mountain, with a cross, and then even more, you know, seemingly less related things. There's an interesting, later in the chapter, there's an interesting discussion about just the sort of overcoming the opposites. It's most poignantly sort of, you know, presented in the male and the female. And then there's kind of a Gnostic story about that that was sort of intriguing, but I can't really do justice to try to recap right now.
Is that because it's a dirty story?
No, it's not a dirty story. that's all I have to say right now. Chris?
My big problem with this whole chapter is my own experience, recent experience, so overwhelms my it gets in the way of everything that I would understand about what Jung is trying to say, because of my own clouded experience. And let me just try to...
Do you want to come in, Molly, and have a seat? There's a seat next to Carol. There's a seat next to Carol, if you want.
The area that I chose to focus on is the last four small sections, and it begins with the issue of torture, and that the process of change, the process of stirring oneself up, the process of digging inside, can at times be torture. And I've experienced this myself through psychotherapy and picking the scabs off of things that I wish I hadn't. And I've experienced it alchemically and pushing beyond things to the point where you can't integrate, you stir up so much you can't integrate it. And so this whole thing of torture, why would we torture ourselves, is a question that I struggle with. But the issue of the creative tension and some of these other things, I guess what bothers me is what's missing from this whole thing. That I think we all know that we can be self-destructive as well as creative. But Jung talks about the whole idea of the symbol of the highest level of consciousness. And let me just read a few lines. This is just lifted out. the motif of a great eagle capable of injuring or making off with a grown man, the image of an obviously gigantic mythical bird circling high in the sky and surveying the earth with the all-seeing eye, is indeed suggestive in view of the content of my book, which is concerned with the fate of man's idea of God. Then on a little bit later, assuming that the eagle is an archaic god image whose power a person cannot escape, then it makes very little difference in practice whether he believes in God or not. The fact that his psyche is so constituted as to produce such phenomena should be enough for him, for he can no more get rid of his psyche than he can get rid of his body, neither of which can be exchanged for another. He is a prisoner of his own physical constitution and must reckon with this fact whether he will or no. One can, of course, live in defiance of the demands of the body and ruin its health, and the same can be done in regard to the psyche. Anyone who wants to live will refrain from these tricks and will at all times carefully inquire into the body's and the psyche's needs. Once a certain level of consciousness and intelligence has been reached, it is no longer possible to live one-sidedly, and the whole of the psychosomatic instincts, which still function in a natural way amongst primitive, must consciously be taken into account. Taking into account of the primitive energies, sort of the backhand of God, if you will, that if you become too intelligent or you know too much, and you get left hanging out there to a certain extent, but you don't have any energy to do anything, then you have to go back somehow to the more primitive level to stir up the force, the life force, to do something. And the problem I see with this whole process of growth and individuation in the philosophical tree is if one has not attained the eagle eye view before one starts, and one does not know when one is caught in one of the negative cycles, then we have the potential of saying, I am God, and going out and becoming a complete psychopath and killing in the name of Allah and retribution in the name of God and all the other good things that come out of these altered states of consciousness. And it seems to me that even though some of us try to be careful and try to be wise, we go plodding into these waters too soon or too fast, and as he warns against us. And for those people who do it without all the understanding and the safeguards and lifeguards built around them, it's not only dangerous, it is demonic. And one of my images of this was shown again on television last night, of a little boy back in a small town in the East, spouting from the Bible at age 8 or 10, telling everybody that they are going straight to hell and that all the kids who go to school are rotten, terrible, you know, and that they should be home studying the Bible and that's all they should do. And it's interesting how if we get caught in that at a much later stage in life and we have much more context, then we can begin to have some understanding of it. But to have these things happen to us early, and many kids do have these things happen early through life circumstances or whatever, without any context for it, what a regressive, totally damaging thing it can be. One of the other things that Jung does not bring out in this chapter, which, and I don't know what the sequence of this work was, he wrote a little book called Psychology and Religion. It's a little paperback book that Roger had us read 3 years ago as part of the religion cycle, which talks about the three major problems of dissociation, inflation, and regression. And it's sort of like a prophylactic text before one starts into this. But even after having that experience, how dangerous this process really is. And the process of trying to reattach portions of ourselves that get dissociated is so difficult. And it's when you get into the really spiritual stuff, my own experience is that without help, in some cases, it's almost impossible to come back. And it's not just simple talk therapy anymore, and it's not, you know, some of the rather simple psychological processes. And that's where I guess I'm caught between the philosophical psychologist and the theological psychologist, and I don't know where I'm going to land next, but these larger structures that we have in our civilization are incredible. One of the things that that he doesn't mention in this part of the philosophical tree is in enough depth, I think, is the whole sense of building a false personality. And that it is so easy to fill oneself with holy shit and think you've got something. This is the actual process. And he talks around it, but he doesn't seem to be specific enough, I guess. And this is not an actual workbook, I understand, but let me just read the last couple paragraphs. As well as being an irrational experience, this confrontation is a process of realization. Accordingly, the alchemical opus consisted of two parts, the work in the laboratory with all its emotional and demonic hazards, and the scientia, or theoria, the guiding principle of the opus by which its results were interpreted and given their proper place. The whole process, which we today understand as psychological development, was designated the philosophical tree, or poetic comparison, that draws an apt analogy between the natural growth of the psyche and that of a plant. Then he closes by saying, alchemy lost its vital substance when some of the alchemists abandoned the laboratorium for the oratorium, there to befuddle themselves with an ever more nebulous mysticism, while others converted the oratorium into a laboratorium and discovered chemistry. You feel sorry for the former and admire the latter, but no one asks about the fate of the psyche, which thereafter vanished from sight for several hundred years. And it's amazing how if we get caught in the outer world of science, we lose something. And if we get caught in the inner world of personal experience, we lose something. And to be able to hone the edge, to be able to work both sides, is something that very few people, I think, in our time can hold that edge, the creative edge or the balance. And one of the things that's been fascinating to me that is hopeful is as I go to lectures at Caltech and I see some of these outstanding scientists who have the greatest sense of humor and the greatest sense of play in life. People like Richard Leakey, the anthropologist and mathematicians and computer nuts and all kinds of people who seem to somehow have managed to keep that balance. And it's reassuring because you look around the audience and you say some of these people have lost it one or two times in their life and have come back like I have. And so that's the great thing about modern science is that somehow, even though we do go over the edge, we have the ability through great arts, great doctors and others to redeem these parts of ourselves that get lost to come back into the world. But, I guess in summary, the philosophical tree, I had a lot of experience through, primarily through the Catholic Church in the last few years of growing my own philosophical tree, and it's something that is so so far beyond these descriptions that it's really hard to talk about, and I guess everybody in this room has had some of these experiences that probably would be good. I guess I could close with that.
Okay, thank you all. Thank you all very much, and I'll set some things up for you. If you get interested in the archetypal mythic image of the great eagle is one of the adventures of Sinbad the Sailor, with the adventure with the great rock. Now the person gets into the situation where the great rock comes because he goes to an island. That's a mysterious island out lost in the ocean, and there's a huge cone, mountain, volcanic caldera on this island. And he climbs up to the top because he's heard a story, an old seaman's story, that there are jewels lying on the floor of the crater of the valley. And there are indeed, and there they are down there. But the walls of the inside of the caldera are glass smooth. And he slides down to get the jewels, and he does, he gets the jewels. But he can't get out. And many people have died there. Except Sinbad has been told ahead of time that this great bird, the rock, will come and eat the carrion. And so he plans to grab hold of the great rock, and he comes to feed on the carrion down there and get out that way. And the difficulty is that you go from the caldera to the rock's nest.
Right.